Okay, so thank you very much. I think I'm the first person who is not a theorist, so I apologize. So I tried to understand what I should talk about in a theory day, and I decided I'd talk about something where theory could have a big impact if it were correct. And I'm going to tell you about things that deal with theory, but where there's opportunities for improving theory. And we do our own simple-minded theory, which is really very simple-minded, and it's not really the right way of doing things. So I'm going to, there's been some discussion already about simulations of solids using diffusive motion, Brownian diffusion, things like that. And I'm going to do the same thing. So in this sense, this is an analog computer. I'm going to tell you about analog simulations. I'm going to tell you about colloidal particles that form colloidal crystals, and we use the analogy between the phase behavior of the colloid system and normal solids to learn something about normal solids. Of course, the real interest is, or the real system is the colloidal system, and they themselves are very interesting. The work I'm going to tell you about really is the work primarily of L.A. Slautzkin, who was a postdoc with me a few years ago. He's now at Bar-Ilan University. And Joris Sprockel, who was a more recent postdoc. He's at Wageningen now. And I'm going to try and tell you two different stories, both about colloidal particles. So the reason that we use colloidal particles is that they're a great model system. You can do a lot of statistical physics thinking about the colloids and take advantage of the fact that with current technology, you can image the colloids and you can identify the location of each and every particle and follow it both in space and in time. And the particles are large enough that you can see them. They're typically of the order of a micron. They're slow enough that you can follow their evolution in time. So a typical time constant is sort of milliseconds. That might be how long it takes a particle to diffuse its own size in when it's by itself. Everything gets slowed down when they become concentrated. And so the model is to think of each colloidal particle behaving like an atom or a molecule in a solid and look for the analogies between these and learn something about the behavior both of the colloidal system, but we hope about the solid system as well. And I'll show you examples where we can think about these things. So this is a relatively famous picture. Those of you who may notice it will realize that I've shifted it around so that the volume fraction is increasing this way. When it was published, it was flipped over. This is a picture that Peter Pusey published with Bill Van Magen something like 30 years ago. And this started a lot of the effort of the physics community in trying to use colloids as a model system. In fact, the actual work started about 10 or 15 years earlier, and Randy mentioned that with a study of 91 nanometer colloidal particles, and I'll come back to that in the second half of the talk. The important thing here is that you're increasing the volume fraction of the colloids, and these colloids are acting as close to hard spheres as it was possible to achieve in those days. I think we can get them acting even more as hard spheres now. And hard spheres, this is probably the only time that quantum mechanics will come into anything I talk about. They can't overlap in space. That's the Pauli principle or something like that. Actually, it's just they can't take the same space, right? That's what hard spheres are. There's no interaction except that they can't overlap each other. In fact, there's a very weak, very, very short range interaction. But essentially, they're interacting like hard spheres. And as you increase the volume fraction, you can see that there's an increasing amount of crystal material. So these are colloidal crystals. And this is a very well studied field. In fact, we heard earlier today that now you want to make diamond lattices because diamond lattices may have photonic band gaps, blah, blah, blah. This has been going on for years, and nobody's ever made a photonic band gap with colloidal systems, as far as I can tell. But everybody keeps trying. But you can use these systems as a really beautiful way of studying the properties of crystals and trying to understand something very, very fundamental. And I want to ask a very, very simple question about this system. Let me explain just a little bit about how the system forms, and then I'll show you what I'd like to ask. So if you look at the phase diagram, because they are hard spheres, there is no interaction energy whatsoever. So in fact, temperature is not an important variable. Instead, what's important is just the volume fraction. And by controlling the volume fraction, you can control their phase of the system. It's like controlling temperature, but you just control volume fraction. And so below 49%, the colloids don't order. They have an amorphous structure. They're a disordered structure. If these are perfect, I'm assuming they're perfectly monodispersed, perfectly uniform in size. Then at 49%, you can start forming crystal structure. And that lasts till about 54%. So you have a coexistence of a fluid and a crystalline structure till 54%. Above 54%, everything is crystalline, provided they can order. And if they can't order, they can be trapped in a disordered state, and that's a colloidal glass. And I'm not going to describe any of the physics about that, which is, of course, very interesting. But instead, if they are ordered, they can exist between 54 up to 74%. That's the maximum you can pack. If you take a hexagonal packing, a hexagonal stacking of spheres, you can pack them to 74%. That's, in fact, a very important number, because if you insist that they remain disordered, you can only pack them to about 63 or 64%. That's random close packing. That's the packing, the maximum packing that you can achieve if they're disordered and you have uniform spheres at 64%. Now, why that's important is that, in fact, you have extra space if you order them. And since there is no temperature involved, everything is controlled by entropy. And the meaning of entropy is essentially free volume, the amount of extra space there is. So since you can have more space if you order them, you actually increase the entropy, therefore lower the energy by ordering the system. And that's what drives crystallization. So you can see this in this little schematic. This is a two-dimensional visualization, but it captures the physics. If I take the same number of particles and I make them disordered, you see that they're jammed in. Many of these things can't move at all, whereas if I put them in an ordered lattice, there's a lot of extra space. And it's this additional space that makes them energetically favorable to crystallize. And so it's something that's driven by entropy. Entropy, you normally think, leads to disorder, but in this case, entropy is actually leading to ordering. And that's why you get colloidal crystals. So we can use this now to understand something about crystallization. And instead of changing the temperature to cause crystallization, we can just change the volume fraction. That's the control parameter. That's the thermodynamic control parameter. So I want to ask a very, very simple question. How do the crystals form? What's really unique and special about a system of colloidal crystals is that they're soft. They're soft because they're large. The elasticity of a system is just essentially some energy divided by a volume. And the energy for colloidal crystals is thermal energy. And the volume is the size of the particle. There's lots of correction factors, but that's close enough. And if you calculate, therefore, what an elastic modulus, which is just that ratio, the energy over the volume, it's of order pascals or tens of pascals. It's very, very soft. That's why they're a soft material. What that means is I can easily melt the system just by shaking it. I can shear melt it. So I can start with a disordered system and ask, how does it crystallize? I can take a system that wants to crystallize. I can disorder it by shaking it, by stirring it, by mixing it. It's like taking this building. It's, if there's some crystalline area in this building, I just stir it up. Well, you normally can't do it. You have to heat it up until it melts. But you don't have to with these systems. They're soft. So you can melt them. And then you can ask just, how does the crystal form? I want to ask a very, very simple question. How does the crystal form? Of course, the mechanism for formation of crystals is that you nucleate a crystal and you watch it grow. It's the nucleation and growth process. And that should be something that we really should understand completely. So this is just showing different volume fractions. This is clearly a disordered system. This is clearly an ordered system. This is an ordered system, but there's a polycrystalline, so there's lots of regions of disorder. This region, you have to ask, you know, it will eventually order, but it's disordered. What I want to do is identify the incipient crystals and watch them grow. So you can look in the literature, and this is something that's been studied for quite a while. And in fact, if you even go back to this famous picture, and you actually ask yourself some simple questions, there are actually some crystals forming here. And if you ask yourself some simple questions, like, why do I see them? Should I see them? What you really want to ask is, how long does it take for the first nucleation of crystals? And here are some experimental measurements as a function of volume fraction. These are done with light scattering. They're quite old measurements. These are probably done by Schatzel and Ackerson. You can see that they're getting to the point where they nucleate. And this is the nucleation rate. And notice that it's dropping by orders of magnitude. But in that picture that you saw with Peter's data, you saw nucleation already at right around the boundary where you just get a very small amount of nucleation. So things do nucleate, even though they're very close to the phase boundary. Well, this is a system that we should understand completely. It is just a hard sphere system. It's a system that's been studied theoretically and through computer simulation for years. And Dan Frankel, who really does wonderful computer simulations, has calculated the nucleation rate. And here are his calculations. This is done by simulation. It's a paper published about 13 years ago. And you see that he certainly can understand the data at the boundary where everything crystallizes. But in this coexistence regime, he's off. And notice that they're off by something like 10 orders of magnitude. Well, if you think about nucleation, 10 orders of magnitude is really not that much, because you can understand, well, just wait. Laugh now, but wait, wait. Why it's not that much is because it's an exponential process. You can understand nucleation in a very, very simple form. And this is not a bad way of thinking about it, at least to understand the physics of it. Basically, you have a lower energy, a bulk energy, if it's crystalline. But you always have an interfacial energy that is the boundary between the crystal region and the fluid region. And there's always a cost to an interfacial energy. So it's a balance between an interfacial energy, which wants to make things shrink and disappear, and a bulk energy, which makes things grow. The bulk energy grows as the volume. The interfacial energy grows as the area. So in fact, the interfacial energy dominates at small enough crystals. And so the change in energy looks like this. There's a maximum here. And you have to reach that maximum before you can actually grow. Otherwise, things will disappear. And you can see that by the probability of, or the nucleation rate is proportional to some time constant, which is roughly some diffusion coefficient. Or related to diffusion coefficients and the size, and this exponential factor of this free energy divided by kT. And so you can see that the rate of nucleation depends exponentially on this difference of energy. So orders of magnitude, well, OK, if you're within a few orders of magnitude and you're doing nucleation rates, you're doing really well. And it's always the case. So that's why, because it comes in exponentially. So really what you're asking is, you know, what's the balance between the surface energy and the bulk energy? And you have to get to some critical size where it's large enough that the bulk energy can start to dominate. Otherwise, things shrink away. And that's basic nucleation and growth. And so the fact that you're way off is really ubiquitous when you look at nucleation rates. So I'm telling you about a soft system. This is what I call a hard system. It's hard because there's all these different components to it. But here are some plots of experiments and theory for nucleation rates. And you can see that, you know, what's this, about 25 orders of magnitude. It's off. But OK, people do as well as they can. And really, with hard spheres, we should do pretty well. We should be able to understand that. So we decided we'd go back and look at these things, and we do it rather than the way that Schatzel and Akerson did it, which was the way that people typically worked in the early days, let's say when Peter started. You typically didn't visualize things, but rather you did scattering, and they did scattering. Scattering is a wonderful way to get a good average over a system, but it's not so good for understanding the details. So if you wanted to understand the details, you want to go to some kind of microscopy. Randy told her what we have to do is do a confocal microscopy so you can see in three dimensions, and so we do that. This is a typical setup for doing confocal microscopy, and you can visualize the particles, you can track their motion. This is all now very standard. You can learn a great deal of the motion. Like, for example, if you track the motion of these, if you track the motion of these particles, this is the y position of one of these particles as a function of time. You can see the fluctuations. From that, you can calculate the mean square displacement. You can calculate everything. You can calculate the second order statistics, so you can calculate the step size distribution as a function of time or a time difference. And it's Gaussian, everything. You can measure the diffusion coefficient. I mean, you really can understand things well. More typically, you look at many particles. And even more typically now for these systems, you look at particles that look like this. You look at a large number of particles. And this is just a rendering of a large number of particles. These are real experimental data. Everything I'm going to show you is based on experiment, on real data, even if I visualize them by some kind of rendering. So that this is what my friend and colleague, Franz Papen, calls a perfect analog computer, because now we can do what you can do in simulations, but you do it with all the physics of the real system, just by watching the position of the as a function of time of the particles. So if we want to do nucleation and growth, we have to look at a system like this, and we have to identify the incipient crystals. We do that by defining an order parameter. This is exactly what's done in simulations. You define an order parameter. I won't go through all the details, but basically you take each particle, you look at its nearest neighbors, you project the nearest neighbors onto spherical harmonics, you take a dot product of spherical harmonics of two different particles, you look at certain dot products of spherical harmonics, and you can define a crystal order parameter. There's some ambiguity in how you define it, so you test and you see that it really doesn't, the results don't really affect, are not really affected by exactly how you define it. But each particle then can be, you can determine each particle, is it a crystal or not? So even a single particle can be declared to be crystalline because the symmetry, the orientational symmetry of the particles in its neighborhood are those of a crystal lattice. That's really what we're asking. So here's some early experiments. These were done sort of, a long time ago in the time frame that Dan was doing his simulations. We used an analog computer. We just followed the crystallization of these colloidal particles. So here's a system. The way I'm visualizing this was obviously done a long time ago, so we don't have fancy graphics to show it. Instead, we use small particles, so you can see through them. They're blue. And the particles drawn to scale are red, and those are the particles that we call crystalline. And we can watch how it crystallizes over time, see nothing happens, and then eventually a crystal forms and it grows. So this is really an analog computer to watch the nucleation and growth of the crystals. And as in the case of the light scattering data, we found nucleation rates much faster than you would predict. But we could go and look and study more about them. So for example, we could look at all the nuclei, both those that do grow and those that don't grow, and we could plot their mass, that's the number of particles in the nucleus. What we're doing is we're saying this is crystalline, we just look at all its nearest neighbors. If the nearest neighbor is crystalline, we count that as part of a nucleation site. So we look at these, we plot the mass as a function of the radius of gyration, of the size of these things. We find a nice power law correlation, but it's not the way it should be. It's not a solid particle, it's a fractal object. It's fractal dimensions about 2.5. And if we look more carefully, we saw that the boundary between the fluid region and the incipient crystallization was about 42% rather than 49%. So it's a little bit lower. And from that, we concluded that these were slightly softer, slightly charged particles. And so the fact then that you didn't see or you saw nucleation rates that were much faster might just be, well, OK, they're charged particles. So over the years, we've gotten better. Certainly the main contribution to this is the group of Van Bladeren in Utrecht. But a lot of people have worked on making really good particles where you could, they're as close to hard spheres as you can get. They're fluorescent. I won't go through the details of the system. It doesn't really matter. But here's a now more recent measurements where we really tested first to make sure that we had a hard sphere system. So the way we tested, we did a lot of tests. Here's just a few things to try and prove that. The way we did that was we took a system that was coexisting. Here's a system. You can see this is crystalline, this is fluid. And we analyzed the behavior of the fluid and the crystal separately. So for looking at the fluid, we just plotted the structure factor. We fit this to a Perkis-Jevic form. From that, knowing the size, you can you fit as a function of volume fraction. And when we fit, we found that the volume fraction of the crystal, of the fluid, this region, the volume fraction is 0.49, which is exactly what it should be in this coexisting region. And then we did a similar kind of analysis. We did the Voronoi analysis, basically to calculate what the volume of the of each particle, and therefore what the volume fraction is in the crystal range. And we found something like this, but it's really centered right around the volume fraction you would expect for a crystal. So this and a lot of other measurements convinced us now that we really have a hard sphere system. So now we can go back and redo all the same sorts of measurements. So you can watch, this is the growth of the crystal. This is just the average number of, or definition of how crystalline the whole sample is. And you can see there's a delay time, which you always find. There's some delay time because things don't form. And then things start to crystallize and eventually become completely crystalline. But now when we look at it, look at this. This is the data that we took now for the nucleation rates. And they're much faster. And in fact, we can go much closer to the phase boundary where the sample is just the incipient crystallization. And in fact, you know that you can do that because you saw in that very famous picture of Peter that he could go right down very, very close to the phase boundary, right near the phase boundary. And it still crystallizes. And in his case, it still crystallizes. He didn't wait a long time. He just formed these crystals. So now you have to go back and you have to take Frankel's data and compare it. And now I can't even plot it on this same graph. I have to put a break in it. Now it's not 10 orders of magnitude, 150 orders of magnitude. 150 orders of magnitude. Well, OK, you know, 10 orders of magnitude, maybe you can accept. 20, OK, but 150, that's just too much, really. Even, I mean, we're experimentalists. We're condensed matter, 150 orders of magnitude. That's not, you're not talking about cosmology. It's really something real. 150, that just seems to be too much. So what's going on? Well, we have the advantage that we can go and we can look at exactly what's happening. So let's analyze the structure of the nuclei as they form. So here we're just snapping through some images. These are three-dimensional images. This is real data. Notice that occasionally you see what looks like an incipient crystal, but it disappears. It melts away. It's too small. It melts away. Eventually, something forms, and that grows. In fact, this one will grow. I don't show it. So we can analyze all of these crystals. What we can do, for example, is look at every nucleus and then look at the next time step and ask, measure its size. We can measure its size by measuring its mass. That's an absolutely well-defined size. And ask, in the next time step, does it grow or does it shrink? And collect probability of growth and shrinkage as a function of size. So here's the probability to shrink. You can see that if they're very small, the probability is close to 1 that they'll shrink. But then as they get larger, they grow. And similarly, you can do the same thing for asking whether they shrink. You see this. And now you can see where this crosses. And you have a nice definition of what the critical mass is. This is the mass where the critical nucleus, above this size, the particles, the nuclei will grow. Below the size, they'll shrink. So you can go now and look at these things. And this is one where we know it's going to become critical, so we can watch its growth. And here's what happens. And the important thing to notice is these are not spheres. They're very irregular shape. They're very spread out. And this is how it looks. OK, so now let's think about what this really means. Let's look at some of the statistics that we can, for example, calculate the number of nearest neighbors per particle. If they were a solid, they'd have 12 nearest neighbors if they're crystal. But if you look at the number of nearest neighbors of those, the average number of nearest neighbors for the nuclei that shrink, it's distributed like this. The ones that grow, it's distributed like this. You see a slight difference, a little bit more for the ones that grow. So they're slightly different. Their shape is slightly different. So we really ought to go back and look at the shape of these structures. So we can look, for example, plot now the radius of gyration. This is the average radius of gyration as a function of mass. So the mass is well defined, but the shapes are different. So we can plot the average radius of gyration as a function of mass. This is something we should be able to calculate. If they're compact objects, it would look like this. Actually, it would look like this because you can't pack. As the numbers are small, they're sort of magic numbers that you can pack a little better. So it looks something like this. And clearly, they have a larger radius than that. If they're completely disordered, completely random, so this is what you would call a lattice animal. You can just put things anywhere on a lattice as long as they touch and ask what the average size is and just calculate all the different average sizes, it would look like this. So these clearly lie somewhere in between. But you can actually then go back and try and calculate that. You can calculate, what's the average radius of gyration? Well, I can do that, and I can just calculate all the radius, but weight them by this free energy. And if you weight them by this free energy, you can recast this in terms of a bulk and a surface term. But we know the critical mass, so we can just put this all in terms of the surface term. So it's like saying there's some surface area, surface energy. And so we can take these data, and we can fit them just to a surface energy. And you get a value of about a half kT over the radius squared. And that's not an unreasonable value. So this explains the data fairly nicely. You can go back and you can do the same data of our old data. And you see that, in fact, they had a much lower surface energy. You can, instead of calculating the radius of gyration, you can calculate the area, the average area for the clusters. And now you know what the surface tension is. You can do the same calculation, and it works really well. This is now just a calculation of what it would be using the value of the surface tension that we determined previously. So we can ask other things. So one very simple thing to ask is, what's the distribution of the clusters? So what's the distribution as a function of their size, the number of clusters as a function of mass? And because you have this exponential dependence on free energy, this is like this is the effect of the surface tension. It's exponential. You expect some exponential dependence. So you should plot on a semi-log plot. This is linear. This is log. You should plot the number of clusters. And this is what it looks like. But if you don't think about it too much and you plot it the way to best display the data, it turns out that if you plot it on a log-log plot, it really describes the data more clearly. It's some sort of power law. This is the number as a function of the logarithm of the mass, and that's a reasonably good power law. And in fact, you can do that for different volume fractions, and you get a reasonable power law. But if you then, we know how to calculate. We've measured the surface energy. We can calculate this. If you try to calculate it, you see that you really don't get that good agreement. You have many more clusters of incipient clusters that are larger, which of course explains why it's faster. So it's much faster than you would expect. Well, we can do a lot of other things. Since we know what the critical mass is, we can recast the surface energy and the bulk energy in terms of this critical mass. So here's the surface, the bulk energy cast in those terms. And so we can use all the experimentally measured data, the surface energy we've measured and the critical mass we've measured, that gets us the bulk energy. And again, we can get better agreement, but it's still not that good. So there's something else that's happening. So what else could we do? Remember, everything is entropy. Well, the thing that we haven't really addressed is the fact that you saw that the clusters are really spread out, and there can be a lot of different shapes of clusters. So there's another term of entropy just because you have lots of possible shapes for any given mass of cluster, lots of possible radii. So let's go back and just insert that back in the free energy. And you can do this. This is something that's been done many times in nucleation and growth theory. I won't go through the details. This is an early version of something. This was done for fluids, but it's the same sort of thing. You're allowing for the many different possible shapes of the incipient crystals. So there's an entropy in the different shapes. And you put this term in. It turns out that you can understand something about it. It gives this additional term and this additional mass term. We can calculate all of the things, and we can also fit them. And now you get really good agreement between this distribution. The only assumption is that we're assuming some power law distribution of mass. That's what everybody else does. We use the same exponent that everybody else does. We could fit the exponent, but it's not very sensitive to the exponent. It really doesn't matter. But you really get pretty good agreement between the distribution of clusters and what you measure. So now we can go back and we can take all these things that we fit. We put this back into this free energy term. We know all the terms. So we can take this now and use this same form and calculate what the nucleation rate is. Again, we're just putting into an exponential, so if we're even close, we're going to be surprised because, as I said, you know, with nucleation rates, the orders of magnitude different. But if we do that and we just use this new energy functional term, you get really good agreement between what you measure and what you see. So this suggests that really the origin of why there's this discrepancy between what you're calculating is you're not allowing for the entropy of all these different forms. And you might ask, well, they're doing simulations. Why are they mixing it? Well, they have to do really a lot of tricks to calculate what should be very low nucleation rates at very close to the boundary. So they do a lot of theoretical tricks to what they call umbrella sampling. They have to make some assumptions how they sample. And they're limited in the size of the box that they use. These things can be very large because they're very tenuous clusters. So I think they just may have missed some of the contribution of this. This seems to tell us what it is. You actually go back and you look at real materials, you see that, in fact, the surface energies of the hard sphere collards are not so different from surface energies of metal. And you can't do these experiments with metals, but you can do simulations. So here's a simulation. This is not anything. It's a real quantum mechanical simulation of nucleation of copper crystals. And interestingly, they don't comment on it in this paper, but they plot the distribution of clusters. They plot in a log-log plot, and they do indeed see a power law distribution. And if we take this same, if we take this distribution and fit it with this same free energy form, we actually get a very good agreement. So it does seem also to apply, or may apply, to more traditional solids. OK, I'd like to spend just a few minutes. I've told you now why things crystallize much faster. Let me just tell you a little bit about how they melt. I think that's also interesting. That's also something you can study. In fact, Arjun Yod published a beautiful paper in Science, and he showed that he studied the melting of colloidal crystals. Here's colloidal crystals. He studied how they melt. He changed the volume fraction. This is a lovely experiment where he can change the volume fraction continuously by changing the size of the colloids. And he saw, not surprisingly, that if there's any defect here, some disclination or some line of defects, that's where they melt. They always melt at the boundary of crystals. And so he just followed and showed, as you would expect, that they melt. But the question is then, and this is always the case, melting always occurs at the interface. So the interface always melts first. What happens if I have a crystal that doesn't have any interfaces? What happens then? How can you understand it? Well, it turns out that there is another theory for melting that was devised by Max Born in 1939. And he says, well, if you have no interfaces, they can melt because there's a catastrophic collapse of the elasticity of the crystal. But this has never really been seen. So you actually can make a perfect crystal with colloids using the system that Randy referred to, the system that people first studied. These are these charged particles. And what you make is what's called a Wigner lattice. Basically, it's particles that are charged, so they repel each other. They're trying to spread apart as much as they can. But if you contain the volume so they can't spread apart, they actually form a crystal lattice. It's a very, very soft lattice because they're very widely separated, and they can become a perfect crystal, and it can remain a perfect crystal until the boundaries of the sample. So there are no interfaces. So you can make a sample that looks like this. And OK, there's a lot of studies. Maybe I'll skip this just because of time. We use colloidal particles that are charged in a non-polar, not in water, but a non-polar solvent. I won't go through the details of this. It turns out you can do this very easily. All you have to do is solubilize the counter ions. You can do that by adding surfactant. And then you can make a charged system, so a repulsive system, but in a nonpolar solvent. The nice thing about that is that because the dielectric constant is not 80 like it is in water, it's 2 like it is in oil, length scales get very large. And so you can see things with a much larger length scale. You can study them more easily. So I'll skip all of this, how we do it. This is just an example. This is, again, a confocal microscope image. This is a non-crystalline sample. The volume fraction is lower. But you can see that they're slightly ordered in the case where they're charged. And if we screen out the charge, just like you would do with a salt system, you screen it out, then they become very highly disordered. So you can charge them up. But now the size is large enough that you can see it with a confocal microscope very easily. So we can make a Wigner lattice. It looks like this. You can change the temperature. I'll just be a minute. And this is where it gets to be close to melting. You increase the decrease the volume fraction. And you see the phase behavior. You see that it's BCC, FCC, and fluid. There may be a coexistence. We're not really sure about this. But what we can do now is ask, how does it melt? So first of all, we look at the mean square displacement. This is where it's crystalline. This is where it's fluid. So what we can do is we can ask, we can assign, you saw how they fluctuated. You can measure the amount of fluctuation. That's called the Lindemann parameter. It's called the Lindemann parameter because one way of defining melting is you get a Lindemann parameter greater than 10% of the separation, a sample should melt. That's one way of, an empirical way of looking for melting. But here we can measure the Lindemann parameter as you get closer to melting, and you see that the number of samples that have Lindemann parameters larger than a quarter is quite large, because when it melts, the Lindemann criterion, the Lindemann parameter, is 25%. That is, the samples still are on the crystal lattice, but they're fluctuating a quarter of the diameter. They're still crystalline, but they're really hugely fluctuating. So these ones that are fluctuating large are superheated. There's some simulations that this agrees with. You can look at this. I'll skip over this to be a little quicker. You can see that you can measure the elastic constant. You see there seems to be a sudden collapse when it melts. But we can now, this has all the appearance of warm melting, but we can look at it in more detail. So we can, for example, look at the size of the regions that are superheated as we increase the temperature, that is, we decrease the volume closer to melting. And we see that there's clusters that form, and the clusters get larger and larger. So what this says, one way of understanding it, is you have these superheated particles, and you get this Born collapse. You get this elastic collapse when they percolate across the sample. That's one way of physically understanding it. But OK, I'll skip over. I'll just show you a couple of interesting facts of that. If you calculate, this is the average size of the clusters that are superheated as a function of volume fraction, but plotted as a logarithmic difference between the melting point and where you see it. And you see that there's this power law dependence of the number of clusters, of the size of the clusters as they approach the melting. Similarly, you can plot the volume fraction. And again, you get this power law dependence. This is the volume fraction of the clusters. You can even plot the elastic modulus, and you see also this critical behavior. You see a power law dependence of the elastic modulus as it approaches the melting. In fact, if you go back and you replot Born's calculation, his own data shows exactly the same thing. So what's really cool about this is that you see this incipient melting. You see, as you approach melting, you can see something that tells you it's going to melt. You see a power law approach to melting. What does that say? What does that remind you of? Whenever you see a power law approach to melting, and a power-logic approach to anything, that's like a critical behavior. That's a second-order transition. A second-order transition has these fluctuations as you get close to it. But melting in three dimensions is strictly first order. But here's an example where melting has an incipient, has a look to it like second order. And so think about this. Think about melting of crystals as a function of dimension. Well, in one dimension, you really can't ever have a crystal, so it's sort of always two-dimensional melting. In two dimensions, you also get second-order melting. You get this ecstatic phase. And here's an example in three dimensions where if you have this perfect lattice, if you have Born melting, it has this critical second-order character to it. I'm not saying it's truly second-order, but it certainly has a lot of character to it, like second order. Okay, I hope I've showed you that there's a lot of things that we can learn just about really simple fundamental physics just by looking at these colloidal crystals, and I'll take time for questions, and thank you for your attention.